It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. They may not even tell their roommates, but according to recent surveys, the number of college students seeking help for serious psychological problems has soared in recent years. All across the U.S., campus counseling centers are straining to keep up. And in the first of two stories, we'll hear the perspective from the students. NPR's Deborah Franklin has this report, which involves a group of students in California who created a theater production that got their campus talking.
Amanda Galender is a senior at Stanford University, confident with a big laugh. As she recalls, she was having coffee off campus last winter with a new friend, a freshman, when it struck her that he might not be as happy as he seemed.
He starts talking about his friend in the dorm who's really, really depressed, and like he feels really bad for this kid. And I just had an instinct. I don't know why I did it, but I just told him, I'm bipolar and I know how hard that is.
Amanda had spent her freshman year depressed too, crying under the covers for hours and exhausted, trying to hold everything together.
And I would cry on my way to class. And every day when I got home from class, I told my roommate that I had to take naps. And it wasn't about anything in particular. It was just sadness, a sadness that I couldn't shake. And I didn't care about anything. I didn't care about my friends. I didn't want to socialize with anyone in my dorm. And this was very uncharacteristic of me. I'm someone who dives into activities and academics. I didn't want to get help. I thought I could do it on my own. So it was just a very lonely time.
The young man listened to her story and confessed that the depressed friend was really him. It was a relief to them both to come clean, but Amanda and her friend wondered how many others were suffering, and that's when they got their big idea. Both are members of a student theater group that shines a spotlight on social issues, homelessness and AIDS, farm workers and pesticides.
We decided that it would be great if we could get stories to show that there is such life happening under the surface about mental illness, that there is so much struggle and triumph going on.
So they sent out an email to everyone they knew on campus, asking for anonymous true life stories. And within half an hour, Amanda got the first response. She brings it up on her laptop.
Am I the only person who never feels good? I've always felt this way from as long as I can remember, and all I've wanted is for somebody to say, I know how you feel. I am the same. We are all the same.
Dozens more letters poured in. What it's like to be hauled off to the psych ward for observation, or to stand at the edge of a high balcony and fight with yourself to keep from jumping. Before we tell you what Amanda Galender and her friends did with all that email, you first need to know these kids' struggles are not unusual. A Stanford task force on student mental health last year reported what it called an unprecedented demand for psychological services on campus. Roughly twice as many students seeking help as a decade ago. To try to keep up, Stanford increased its staff from 10 therapists to 16 in just the last year. Other schools are even more swamped.
We're not seeing that it's specific to elite schools by any means.
Daniel Eisenberg is a mental health researcher at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He cites surveys of college counseling directors published over the last decade, schools ranging from small community colleges to the largest universities.
And one of the questions is whether they're seeing an increase in the number and severity of students with mental health problems, and over 90% are saying yes to that question.
Here are some more stats from colleges nationwide. More than twice as many students are on psychiatric medications as a decade ago, and there's been a 50% increase in the diagnosis of depression. Last January, Amanda Galender, the Stanford student you heard earlier, was determined to go deeper, to give all those numbers a human face. So she and her troupe of actors turned some of the letters they'd collected into 25 monologues. One even came in from a student resident advisor in the dorms.
One night, I sobbed in bed until 5 a.m., I imagine depression feels different for different people. For me, it felt like an elephant was sitting on my chest, constricting my heart, and I could barely breathe. I'm not supposed to be like this, I kept telling myself. I need to be strong. Other people come to me for help. I started to panic. What if I can't graduate? What if I have to drop out of medical school? What if I can't take care of a family?
The actors took their show to various places around campus, making sure faculty and the counseling center had a chance to hear the stories. But Amanda Galender says there were two audiences that were most important.
First and foremost, people who were struggling with mental illness and thought, there's no one else out there like me. Secondly, we're trying to reach people in dorms who are complicit in creating an environment that is hostile to people with mental illness, even if they don't know it.
And so they performed in 13 student dorms, too. Stories of severe anxiety problems, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and eating disorders.
It doesn't help my self-esteem that people think of bulimia as a joke problem, gross and unrespectable. It's an issue of control. Who overeats like a dumb animal and then has to vomit because they have no self-restraint? Me, apparently. It's embarrassing. But beyond that, it was also that I was on a varsity team and knew that if news got to my coach or the sports medicine, I would risk my spot on the team.
When you hear OCD, you probably think of some Jack Nicholson type. Neat freak. Really uptight. But that's not me at all. Hell, in terms of neat, I live in a frat.
By junior year of high school, I couldn't even listen to the radio during a traffic report because I would just know that my family had been in an accident. I started thinking that every furtive-looking man on the street was a terrorist, that every plane flying overhead was going to crash into my house. 20 milligrams of Prozac a day changed my life. So I went to Stanford relatively healthy, happy, and excited. In December, my young grandmother died of a sudden aneurysm. That winter quarter, I had a panic attack in the middle of a math exam. It was time to seek help again.
The stories inspired lots of Facebook discussion about mental illness. Some students found the production too disturbing, but Amanda Galender got a lot of positive feedback, especially from resident advisors, the RAs.
I spoke with an RA who said that this was probably the best thing that has been done for mental health on campus in a long time. He could really sense a change in his dorm.
So the Stanford student actors got what they most wanted, to dispel some of the stigma of mental illness. It's a good start, but is there really some new epidemic of psychological problems on campus? Researchers say it's doubtful that today's teens are actually sicker than past generations. Instead, they suspect what we're seeing is partly the unintended consequence of a good thing. 20 years ago, many high school kids with an illness as difficult as bipolar disorder or major depression might not have gotten treatment or even made it to college. Again, the University of Michigan's Daniel Eisenberg.
When Prozac and other antidepressant drugs came onto the scene in the late 80s and in the 90s, the likelihood of teenagers getting mental health treatment went way up.
Now, with earlier diagnosis and better treatment, they're on every campus. And when they have problems, many more are turning to therapists for help. Deborah Franklin, NPR News.
And we have more of the Stanford monologues at npr.org.
Why did I let myself sleep all day, stay up all night, stop eating, stop caring, and a few times, almost stop breathing?
Next Monday, we'll hear how colleges are reacting to this big increase in demand for mental health services, especially at a time of tight budgets. There are schisms within religions over doctrine or social issues. Now there's a split among atheists over religion. The new atheists insist that religion is dangerous and should be treated with contempt, while the old guard says they should work with believers. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports.
On September 30th, atheists around the world gathered to celebrate Blasphemy Day and the freedom to denigrate and insult religion. Some offered to trade pornography for Bibles, others de-baptized people with hair dryers, and others committed what the New Testament calls the unforgivable sin.
I deny the existence of the Holy Spirit.
I deny the existence of the Holy Spirit, and I am not afraid.
And the Center for Inquiry office in Washington, D.C., opened a blasphemous art exhibit. One painting, called Divine Wine, shows Jesus on the cross with blood flowing from the wound in his side into a wine bottle. Another shows Jesus after the crucifixion with nail polish.
Well, that's Jesus doing his nails, meaning the nail holes in his hand from the crucifixion. And he's made to look kind of effeminate and silly.
Stuart Jordan says he wouldn't have this on his wall, even though he's an atheist. Jordan advises the center on policy issues. He says the controversy over this exhibit goes way beyond Blasphemy Day. It's about the future of the atheist movement and whether to adopt a more aggressive, often belittling approach toward religious believers.
Some are very much for it. And some are opposed to it on the grounds that they feel, look, this is still a largely religious country, and if it's pushed in the wrong way, this is going to insult many of the religious people who should be shown due respect.
Jordan believes the new approach will backfire. Now, he could speak his mind, since he's a volunteer, but interviews with others associated with the Washington office were canceled shortly before we arrived. Curious for a group that promotes free speech. Ronald Lindsay, who heads the National Center for Inquiry, claims he didn't know why the interviews were canceled. As for the exhibit and other Blasphemy Day events they promoted,
what we wanted were thoughtful, incisive, concise critiques of religion. We were not trying to insult believers.
But others are perfectly happy to. New atheists like Oxford biologist Richard Dawkins and journalist Christopher Hitchens are selling millions of books and drawing people by the thousands to hear a clear message.
I think it should be religion treated with ridicule and hatred and contempt, and I claim that right.
Hitchens, a columnist for Vanity Fair and author of the book God Is Not Great, is just as blunt in an interview.
We regard this stuff as ridiculous and sinister and dangerous.
Religion is dangerous, he says, because it can prompt people to fly airplanes into buildings and because it promotes ignorance. Hitchens sees no reason to sugarcoat his position.
If I said to a Protestant or a Quaker or a Muslim, hey, well, at least I respect your belief even if I don't agree with it, I would be telling a lie.
And the more outrageous a message, the better, says P.Z. Myers. Myers writes a blog calling for the end of religion. On Blasphemy Day, Myers drove a rusty nail through a consecrated communion wafer and posted a photo on his website.
People got very angry. I don't know why. I mean, it's just a cracker, right?
Myers, who teaches biology at the University of Minnesota at Morris, says he received about 15,000 hate emails. He says the provocative approach works.
Edgy is what young people like. They want to cut through the nonsense right away. They want to get to the point. They want to hear the story fast. They want it to be exciting. They want it to be fun. And I'm sorry, the old school of atheism is really, really boring.
Paul Kurtz epitomizes the old school. He founded the Center for Inquiry 3 decades ago to offer a positive alternative to religion. He's built alliances with religious groups over issues like opposing creationism in the public schools. Kurtz says he was ousted in, quote, a palace coup last year, and he worries the new atheists will set the movement back.
They're anti-religious. They're mean-spirited, unfortunately. And I think that does more damage than good. I consider them atheist fundamentalists.
He hopes this new approach will fizzle.
Merely to critically attack religious beliefs is not sufficient. What are you for? We know what you're against, but what do you want to defend?
The new atheists counter, they believe in reason, science, and freedom from religious myth. And as Ronald Lindsay, who replaced Kurtz, puts it, we'll take the high road or the low road, whatever it takes to reach people with our message. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
When you fly, who do you think has been taking care of your airplane? Mechanics in Chicago? San Francisco, perhaps? Actually, there's a good chance that your plane had major repairs recently in another country, like Mexico or China or El Salvador. And the reason that U.S. airlines send about 20% of their planes for maintenance in other countries is simple. It's cheaper. The airlines say foreign mechanics keep planes as safe as any repair shop in America, but investigations by NPR and the federal government raise concerns. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling has more.
Do you want to hear where some airlines are sending planes to be fixed? Go to Central America, to the capital of El Salvador. We'll start our visit around the Central Plaza. There are hundreds of market stalls under flimsy awnings, and they give you a quick sense of why more and more American airlines are sending their planes to El Salvador to be fixed. Labor is cheap. A haircut, $1. Avocados, 2 for 25 cents. My interpreter and I stop at a booth where the man's fixing appliances.
What is a typical income here?
I would say between $200 to $250 a month.
Part of you might be wondering, do I want mechanics in El Salvador to fix our planes? And these market stalls provide one possible answer. Mechanics here can fix anything. This guy's taking the motor apart on a kitchen blender. He says a new blender would cost $20, but he's going to fix this one for $10.
You know, if I took a broken blender like that to a repair shop in the United States, they would say, we don't fix that, buy a new one.
Yes,
but here, we always find a way to repair it. All of us are poor.
And he's proud that his countrymen are repairing planes now from the States. And here's how it works. U.S. airlines are supposed to overhaul every airplane at least every couple of years. So companies like JetBlue and U.S. Airways and Southwest fly some of their planes down here. And Salvadoran mechanics strip the inside of the plane down to the bare metal. They fix cracks and rusts and bad wiring. Then they put everything back together and the plane flies back to the States. Kevin Michaels runs an industry consulting firm called Aero Strategy. He says the record shows these global repair shops are doing a great job.
Over the last 10 years, we've seen a significant growth in globalization. And at the same time, air travel has become significantly safer. If this were compromising safety, I suspect we would have seen it by now.
From NBC News in Washington.
Airline companies back in the States used to fix most of their own planes. They had armies of union mechanics. But that started to change back in 2002. That's when the show was broadcast.
American Airlines cuts flights. U.S. Airways files for bankruptcy. Is United next?
The airlines are trying to survive, partly by slashing the cost of maintenance. Consider, if an airline overhauls its own planes in the U.S., it spends up to $100 per hour for every union mechanic. But the airline spends half as much at an independent, non-union shop. And it spends a third as much in El Salvador. So today, the industry is sending most of its planes to be repaired at private repair shops. Almost 20% of the planes are going to developing countries. Do you feel just as confident taking a trip with your family on an airplane that was maintained at a place like El Salvador as a plane that was maintained here in the U.S.?
I trust any aircraft that's been maintained to FAA standards.
Peggy Gilligan helps write those standards. She's the number two official at the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration. A repair shop can oversee the work on U.S. airplanes only if FAA has given its seal of approval. And then the FAA is supposed to keep inspecting it, whether the shop's in the U.S. or overseas. So far, the FAA has approved about 700 foreign repair companies in countries like Costa Rica, Ethiopia, Indonesia.
The system expects that there are lots of eyes looking at work that's done on aircraft and lots of checks and balances to see that the work is being completed properly.
But actually, the Inspector General at the Transportation Department has investigated those checks and balances, and he warns that FAA inspectors keep missing problems at repair shops, especially in other countries. The Inspector General wouldn't talk with us for this story. He says his reports speak for themselves. So we've asked an NPR producer, Diana Douglas, to read excerpts.
FAA still does not have comprehensive data on how much and where outsourced maintenance is performed.
Translation, the FAA does not require the airlines to tell them which foreign repair shops they're actually using. So the FAA isn't sure which they should inspect.
There is no standard for all FAA offices regarding initial inspector visits, which can cause safety issues to go unchecked.
Translation, the FAA's inspectors didn't even show up at some foreign repair stations for as long as 3 to 5 years.
Problems existed, such as untrained mechanics, lack of required tools, and unsafe storage of aircraft parts.
No translation needed. The FAA told the Inspector General they'd correct these problems. Gilligan says they're working on it.
He has made recommendations that FAA improve its oversight, and we take those recommendations seriously.
But so far, FAA has not put most of the changes in place.
These findings are very, very disturbing.
John Golia used to be a presidential appointee on the National Transportation Safety Board. He says FAA has so little information on foreign repair shops that they don't even know if they're worse or better than shops in the U.S. He worries about them.
We don't know what's going on in those facilities. If we're not monitoring them properly, how do we know it's safe?
Look at flying. It's the safest it's ever been.
The absence of an accident doesn't mean you're safe. You should be monitoring and doing our job before there's an accident, not after.
Al proyecto, al proyecto, al proyecto.
Back in El Salvador, I called the company that's fixing the planes. It's called Aeroman, and their executives refused to talk to me. So I found some of their mechanics.
What sort of airlines have you worked on?
JetBlue, U.S. Airways, Frontier.
The mechanics at Aeroman told me a troubling story. Early this year, they overhauled a Boeing 737 for U.S. Airways. On January 23rd, the plane was flying with passengers from Omaha to Phoenix. Suddenly, the seal on the main cabin door started failing. Air started shrieking through the cracks. The plane diverted to Denver. U.S. Airways has confirmed this incident. It turns out that mechanics at Aeroman had installed a key part on the door backward. Daniel Zwerdling, NPR News.
Tomorrow, more potential safety problems at the repair company in El Salvador. You can view an interactive map showing how aircraft maintenance has extended well beyond U.S. borders at NPR.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block in California.
And I'm Michelle Norris in Washington. Here's some real music to your ears. Musical training can improve your hearing. That's the conclusion of several studies presented today in Chicago before the Society for Neuroscience. The studies found that serious musicians can perceive and remember sounds better than the rest of us. And as NPR's John Hamilton reports, it's not because they have better ears.
Sounds come in through the ears, but they travel through our nerves and get interpreted by our brains. Nina Kraus, who directs the Auditory Neuroscience Lab at Northwestern University, says that means your hearing can change even if your ears don't.
Your hearing system becomes tuned by the experiences that you have had with sound throughout your life.
Kraus figured the hearing systems of musicians ought to be more finely tuned than those of other people. So she tested their ability to do something that's challenging for most of us, understanding what someone is saying in a noisy room. 15 classically trained musicians and 16 non-musicians listened to a simple sentence. First, they heard it without any background noise.
Sugar is very sweet.
Then, against a backdrop of quiet conversations.
Sugar is very sweet.
And finally, competing with some pretty loud conversations.
Sugar is very sweet.
Standard hearing tests had shown that the musicians' ears weren't any more sensitive than other listeners. But Kraus knew that their brains, shaped by years of training, had become very good at a similar task.
A musician will be listening to the sound of his own instrument, even though many other instruments are playing.
Not unlike separating one voice from a crowd of voices.
So we wondered, would this skill, which involves your hearing, would it transfer from the music domain into the speech domain? And resoundingly it does.
Kraus says a closer look at musical brains may explain why. Tests show that sounds produce stronger electrical signals in musicians' brain stems, and these signals offer a more accurate representation of pitch, timing, and tone quality, three things that help us pick out a single voice in a noisy room. Another study presented at the neuroscience meeting suggests musical training could help children who are struggling with language.
These kids seem to be impaired in the very areas that musicians excel.
Dana Strait is a PhD candidate in Kraus's lab at Northwestern. She's also studied the oboe and piano for many years. Strait asked musicians and non-musicians to take a simple test.
They were asked to click a button every time they heard a specific sound, but not click a button to other sounds that they might hear.
Musicians not only responded faster and more accurately, they were able to stay focused longer. Many children with dyslexia and other language problems do poorly on tests like this. Strait thinks musical training offers a way to improve their performance.
Musical experience can change how our brain interacts with sound. It's almost like the brain's able to better pay attention to sound and better extract meaning from sound.
That makes sense if you think about the brain and the hearing system as if they were muscles. Mark Jude Tramo is a neurologist at Harvard and directs the Institute for Music and Brain Science.
The way a tennis player is very good at arm wrestling with their tennis hand because their forearms are so strong, a musician who exercises that part of the brain is going to be able to do better on any task that involves auditory concentration.
Tramo says Aristotle wanted music to be part of the Greek educational system because he believed it improved the mind. Now, brain scientists have biological evidence that he was onto something. John Hamilton, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Athens is home to a new hyper-modern museum. It stands at the foot of the Acropolis, and it has a defiant purpose: to convince Britain to give back what we know as the Elgin Marbles. They're the 2,500-year-old sculptures from the Parthenon that were pried off the temple by British nobleman Lord Elgin centuries ago. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli recently visited the new museum and has this report.
For decades, the main argument against the marbles' return was Greece's lack of a suitable location for their display. The new Acropolis Museum is a stunning rebuttal. Designed by Swiss-American architect Bernard Schumi, the five-story building has an area of 226,000 square feet. Its glass-covered walls reflect the images of the Parthenon and surrounding ruins. The museum is the new home for hundreds of archaic and classical statues. Randomly distributed on the floor of a large gallery, it's as if they're part of a crowd milling in the public square, giving visitors a one-on-one, close-up contact with the marble ancients. But it's the top floor that's the museum showcase, says archaeologist Nanya Harmalia.
This is the crown of the building, a glass box and glass surfaces, because the major requirement was the visual link to the Acropolis, to the monument. You can see the monument at the same time the sculpture from the monument.
The display space is the same dimension and orientation as the Parthenon, looming on the Acropolis Hill just 900 feet away. Thanks to the glass wraparound windows, the exhibits bask in the same natural light surrounding the original temple. Roughly half the sculptures that once adorned the Parthenon were chiseled off by Lord Elgin two centuries ago, when Greece was an unwilling member of the Ottoman Empire. He later sold them to the British Museum. Plaster casts of the sculptures housed in London are interspersed with original pieces Lord Elgin left behind. Archaeologist Harmalia says the contrast between the stark white plaster and the ancient honey-colored stone has a specific purpose.
Everybody understands at once what is missing, because if you say numbers, you can understand, but you can see how many are missing.
Extending for 525 feet, the sculptures known as the frieze depict a festival in honor of the goddess Athena, a procession of worshippers performing rituals and musical and athletic contests. The other works, known as metopes and pediments, depict legendary battles and mythological scenes. While pressure on the British Museum has increased, its spokeswoman, Hannah Bolton, firmly rejects repatriating the chiseled marbles to Greece.
They are now museum objects. They are objects of world art. And as such, I don't think there is no problem in terms of them being divided between two different museums and telling two different but complementary stories.
Nevertheless, Acropolis Museum director Dimitris Padermalis says his aim is to reunify the entire composition close to its original setting.
We have from the same figure half of the body in Athens, half of the body in London. We have a body in London and a head in Athens. In London, and the tails of the horses are in Athens. It is a moral problem in art of divided monuments.
The British Museum concedes it could loan some of the sculptures as long as Greece recognizes its ownership of the artifacts, a proposal Padermalis rejects.
They don't belong to the British, they don't belong to us, they belong to history. They are not pieces of trade.
The campaign for the return of the sculptures is part of the international debate over ownership of cultural property. For Greeks, the return of the Parthenon marbles is an issue of national and cultural pride. Maroka Kridi-Ferrari, professor in the philosophy department of Athens University, says the Parthenon and what it symbolizes were traumatized by the sculpture's removal.
They are the material proof of what democracy has built in Athens of the classical period. They are identified with the glory of ancient Greece, and they are part of the national identity.
Sylvia Poggioli, NPR News.
And a rather large and unusual comic book hits bookstores today. It's the work of the bespectacled, gray-bearded artist who is regarded around the world as the granddaddy of underground comics. R. Crumb created Mr. Natural and Fritz the Cat in the 1960s. Now he's taken on what might be his biggest subject ever. Frank Browning reports.
We all know how this book starts.
When God began to create heaven and earth, the earth was then without form and void, and darkness was over the deep, and God's breath hovering over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
The book, of course, is Genesis, all 50 chapters, fully illustrated by Robert Crumb, but with a warning on the cover. Adult supervision recommended for minors. The warning is not just because of the relentless sex that peppers the story, but also, as Crumb said at a press conference, it's a vicious story.
Violence, nastiness, people in a position of power, ruling elites, derive pleasure from inflicting pain and suffering on other humans. That's, you know, about as nasty as people get.
French publisher Jean-Luc Fromental, who's been a Crumb fan since he was a kid, says that at first he couldn't imagine what Robert Crumb would do with the Bible.
To me, I mean, the only way Crumb could get to a project like this was through blasphemy. And then gradually I discovered the pages when they came in, you know, and understood the nature of what he was trying to do, which is reread the whole text from a humanistic point of view without adding a single written commentary to the whole thing, but using only his graphic art.
The characters are all vintage Crumb. The women with the breasts and hips of a young Sophia Loren, the men hairy, hungry animals. Crumb refused any pre-publication broadcast interviews, but he did suggest music to accompany the passage of Eve meeting the serpent in the Garden of Eden. Crumb, who's a world-class collector of 78 RPMs, chose a 1928 version of Blue Blower's Blues by Curtis Mosby and his Dixieland Blue Blowers.
Now, the serpent was the most cunning of all the beasts that the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman,
"Even though God said you shall not eat from any tree of the garden..."
And the woman said to the serpent,
"We may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden, but the fruit of the tree in the middle of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat from it, you shall not touch it, or you will die."
And the serpent said to the woman,
"You shall not be doomed to die, for God knows that on the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will become as divine beings, knowing good and evil."
And the woman saw that the tree was good for eating, and that it was lust to the eyes and lovely to look at. And she took of its fruit and ate.
Crumb spent 4 years working up the illustrations and studying both ancient and modern translations of Genesis, as well as researching parallel Babylonian and Sumerian myths. But as cartoonist and fellow French expat Gilbert Shelton sees it, the brilliance of Crumb's Genesis is in the art.
His technique is as rich as any draftsman that I know of. The drawings in this book of Genesis are complicated and realistic, just fascinating in their clarity. He's an artist's artist.
During an hour-and-a-half press conference, Crumb was repeatedly questioned about his spiritual views and his belief in the Bible. A woman from Finland asked if Crumb believes in God.
"Do I believe in God? Well, I tell people I'm a Gnostic. I'm not an agnostic, I'm a Gnostic, someone who seeks knowledge of God. I believe that obviously there's some force bigger than us that rules our destinies. This is obvious, you know, but what it is a mystery. That's the problem. It's a mystery we cannot possibly understand. We're limited, we're animals, you know."
Taking the Bible as a sacred truth, however, is another matter.
the idea that millions of people for a couple thousand years have taken this so seriously seemed completely insane and crazy. It doesn't need to be satirized. It's already so crazy. I decided it didn't need to be made fun of at all.
Crazy story, perhaps, but the initial print run exceeds 100,000 books around the world, all of which leaves the painfully shy artist more than a little bemused, as when this Danish journalist posed a personal question.
I get that you find people take religious texts too seriously, but don't you think we take comic books and maybe Robert Crumb too seriously?
I think people in the comic book world take me too seriously. Quite often they do, yes.
Thank you.
That's a sad thing to see this happening in the world with comics, taking comics so seriously, but so it goes.
Coming to a bookstore near you, the Book of Genesis, breasts bared and knuckles bloodied, just as it was originally written. For NPR News, I'm Frank Browning in Paris.
You'll find an excerpt and a review of R. Crumb's Book of Genesis, illustrated, on our website, npr.org. And you're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.